I'm Mark Steiner. We are here with Jed Dietz, who is, of course, the founder and director of the Maryland Film Festival, now in its 11th...
Oh, 13th.
13th year. 13th year. It's coming of age,
yeah.
Depending on your culture.
It's our bar mitzvah.
Do you hear a bar mitzvah?
Right.
So, welcome. Good to see you, man.
Thanks. Good to be back.
So, let's talk a bit about... We'll be talking to some of the filmmakers over the course of... conversations about the film festival leading up to this weekend, which starts Thursday night, right?
Thursday night, yep.
So tell me about this festival. This one, there's some interesting things coming into this one.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean, we went into the festival world not thinking we should be a market festival. So unlike Sundance or Cannes, this is a place really to celebrate films, and we don't have any competition. We have no categories.
That's really interesting. Right.
No best actor.
And
the things that emerge are always unpredictable. You know, one of the most fun things I have during the festival is seeing people be totally surprised by some film. Maybe they couldn't get into the one they wanted to go to, and they went to some other one just because they were there, and they're going to have dinner at Tapas, and that's the thing that completely turns them on, and that's what I really love about the festival.
So, what things that you've seen that you know about? You said earlier that you and the two program directors kind of look at these films, hundreds, thousands of films,
yeah.
And then come up with a few you invite to the festival. Not a few, how many?
Well, we'll have over 100, of all types, shorts, features, documentaries, fiction, brand new things. We have a few, of course, old things because we do a guest host program.
Right.
And we've got a couple of people doing extraordinary things. Maren Alsop chose The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, which, of course, was really the film that made Clint Eastwood a movie star.
Right.
I mean, it was the...
So she would... I wouldn't expect Maren Alsop.
Exactly.
Le Maestro of the Symphony to pick The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly?
Exactly. Except, of course, it's one of the great scores ever put to film.
Mm-hmm.
And the relationship between Sergio Leone and Morricone, who did the score, this legendary score, is probably only been duplicated once before in all of movie history, which would be the Prokofiev-Eisenstein partnership. And I was sort of, when I heard the choice, I sort of laughed. I thought, this is what an amazing choice. It's very seldom seen on the big screen anymore. Of course, it's available DVD. And it is an iconic film. And it turns out that Maren, as a young musician, part of what she did to make a living was to do commercials, and she played in orchestras for scoring. And she was conducted by Morricone for the score for The Untouchables.
Really?
Yeah. So she played. You're hearing Maren Alsop on violin when you're at The Untouchables. So she's somebody who's actually had some relationship with Morricone.
Very interesting.
And, of course, as the maestra, she's done lots of stuff at the BSO. I've been to two Chaplin things she's done that have been extraordinary.
Right.
And she clearly loves the movie art form. And so this will really be fun. And then the second one is Kwame Kwai Arma, who's the new artistic director at Center Stage, not even starting until July 1. Is on the board at the National Theatre in London and a smaller theatre, the Tricycle, amongst many other things he's done in London. And he got us the broadcast version of Frankenstein, which is directed on stage at the National Theatre as we speak. It's still running.
Mm-hmm.
Can't get in. It's been sold out since the day it opened. But they did one simulcast in like four or five cities, something new for the National Theatre, and we have it.
They actually film it to show in theaters around Britain? Is that what it is?
Around the world,
I think.
I think they're starting. Like the Met Opera has been doing these simulcasts.
Oh, wow.
I think the National Theatre is just starting to do these things. And because this is a stage production directed by this great film director, Dan Boyle, who, Slumdog Millionaire and Trainspotting, et cetera, we were, really interested in this. And thanks to Kwame, the National has given us a copy of this. And we're going to show that on Friday with him hosting. So it's a slightly sort of hybrid guest host.
That's interesting.
Thing.
I like that.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
Who else is guest hosting?
And the third one this year is a music group called Animal Collective, which is a sort of really cutting edge group. They had a film themselves at Sundance a couple years ago called Odd Sack that was extraordinary. A lot of them have very deep Baltimore roots. I met one of their moms was at the screening I saw at Sundance of Odd Sack. And they've chosen a really obscure Hong Kong film by the Shaw brothers, these classic Hong Kong producers, called The Boxer's Omen. And the print had disappeared. Nobody, I mean, you could get it digitally, but you couldn't find it any other way. And Eric Hatch, our director of programming, found a print from a guy, a theater owner in Vancouver, British Columbia, went into the basement, and there were like 150 film prints from the Shaw Brothers. And so that's what we're going to be showing. I mean, I think it's the only existing film print of this movie that we're going to show.
It's wild.
Yeah.
So now we should tell folks actually about this, where and when this is. We're talking about this starting this Thursday night going through Sunday.
Right. And probably the best way is to go to mdfilmfest.com, which is our website.
Right.
And every film is described. There's a little short description. If you click on that, you'll get a full description just like is going to be in the program. And you can buy tickets right there too.
And at the Charles Theater, all of them? And Micah?
The Charles is sort of our home base, and we build a filmmaker tent village across the street. And everything there is free, by the way. So you get to interact with the filmmakers and go to workshops and panels if you know you're an aspiring filmmaker or just interested in this stuff all through the weekend. And that's all free. And then we use the Brown Center at Micah, which has been a wonderful venue. We'll have opening night there, and we'll have films all through the weekend. And then we're outfitting wind-up space, which is up on North Avenue in Station North Arts District, you know, block and a half from the Charles. We like everything to be within a block, within walking distance, so
right.
A block or two. And so wind-up space is going to be a venue for us. And we, like we do with the Charles, you know, we bring in thousands of dollars worth of equipment. Everything we'll be projecting digitally is in HD cam. You know, so this is a big operation, and wind-up all these spaces are really good venues to see movies in.
So, and it's always an interesting mixture of dramatic film and documentaries.
Yes.
It's always a good balance. Some of them, though, some of the docs we'll be talking about over the course of the hour, like The Interrupters.
Yeah.
About the Chicago gang intervention crew. But it's, and I watched it last night in preparing for these interviews, and it's just an unbelievably powerful film. I just was just blown away by the reality of these ex-gang members, men, women, black and Latino, in the streets. Was just
ex-gang members, drug dealers, murderers, sometimes second generation.
Right.
In one of the cases, and it's funny because this whole thing started from a white epidemiologist, a scientist, you know, who had this insight in about urban violence, you know, that although the police do their work and it is an essential component, it obviously doesn't solve the problem. And he had this insight through some of his studies that if you could get to the violence the minute it happens so that all the ripple effect of it can be stopped, all the revenge back and forth, and, you know, we've seen it, you know, all through urban America, you know, it's not just one killing. It's all the stuff that happens after that one killing.
Right.
And that was the insight. So he figured, this epidemiologist figured, he didn't know how to do that. So he gathered these people, like as you described, who knew the neighborhoods and who knew the people in the neighborhoods. And what the film, as you know, shows is this inaction. And it doesn't always work, but and sometimes it only lasts for a little while. But it is extraordinary to see it.
Very powerful stuff. And I watched a couple of them again the other night, a couple of dramatic things coming through. You have a film from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Viva Riva.
Viva Riva. And the filmmaker's coming in.
The filmmaker's coming in.
Chimango's coming, yeah. We have films coming from all over the world this year. John Waters has chosen a film from France called Domain.
Uh-huh.
And that filmmaker is also flying in from France to be with John. This is the first time – I mean, John does this every year, and it's always a big hit, and this is a wonderful film. But this is the first time we've ever had the director. We've tried a couple times before, but this is the first time the director's been able to be here. So that will be fun. We have a couple South American films. We've got a film from one of the greatest directors on the planet right now, who's Thai, who calls himself Joe. I couldn't possibly – you can find him on the web. I couldn't possibly pronounce it for you. But this won the Palme d'Or at Cannes. I mean, this guy is – we've had his films before. They're singular filmmaking. This is called Uncle Boonmee, Boonmee. And this is a major talent in the world, and he will not be here, but the film
will be here.
Yeah. And Matt Porterfield is hosting a film, a French film, called Nourian Change. You know, more things change, the more
they
stay
the same. Yeah,
that has gotten great play around the world. So it's, you know, like you said, I mean, it's a great mix of films, both foreign and domestic.
It's an amazing mix of films. And it's also just the whole idea that this weekend is just amazing. It's teeming with people and filmmakers and just people who just love watching film. And you can go stay there all day long, go from film to film to film to film. And as you said, across the street, all the kind of free activities to hang out and listen and talk to filmmakers and go to seminars. And
everybody in the neighborhood has responded so beautifully. I mean, the Sophie's Crepe people are open more hours than normal. Tapas is going to have their full menu more hours. So it's a really gathering place. You know, it isn't – I mean, the movies are great and you get to see them with the filmmakers and interact with the filmmakers. But you can do that. You might be sitting at the table next to them too.
Right.
So there's lots of ways to interact.
So, I mean, when you began this 13 years ago, I mean, it's just amazing how this is just become this incredible institution that you every year you keep doing it.
Well, it's you know, when we started, you didn't know. You know,
right.
Did the world need another film festival? Maybe, maybe not. You know, you don't know. And I think we found a way to do it a little differently, you know, with the filmmakers. And there's a kind of, you know, I mean, we put a huge amount of effort into the way it's organized. But there's a kind of accessibility in this festival that you won't find at every festival. And I love other festivals, but and I think the community has responded tremendously to it. And I think it's because, while the creative part of making movies is now more accessible to filmmakers, I mean, all the equipment's gotten better and cheaper, I mean, almost daily, to make films. The marketing has gone just the other direction, where the people who really know how to market films are the experts, the studios, have squeezed down. I mean, they were – 5 years ago, they were marketing 500 films a year, which was less than they were in their heyday in the 40s and 50s. It was way less. But they'd gotten down to about 500 a year. Now last year I think they distributed 170 movies. And
what?
Yeah. And audiences know that they're missing things. They just don't know how to find them. And that's part of where we come in. And we work very hard to select a very, you know, what would you say, a tremendous array. I mean, it's a very amazing art form. And, you know, this weekend you're going to see it. You know, if you can plunge in, you're going to see it in many different angles.
That's interesting. But that it's difficult for filmmakers to survive out here, then. That's the case.
It's very hard. And, you know, making a film is really tough.
Yeah.
You have to call in. I mean, even at the studio level, it's tough because you're making art. You know, and there's not a straight line. You know, you've got to really feel your way into it. But if you have no money and you're feeling your way in, it's even tougher. But even tougher than that is getting to audiences. And that's where we come in. That's our mission.
And you do it well here.
Oh, thank you.
You really will. I mean, every year there's something so exciting, and the people that you meet, you just don't know what's going to pop up. You've got this this film I watched the other night, which is really interesting, Sleeping Beauty.
Oh, well, yeah, and we want to caution everybody. This is not – I mean, it is based
this
on –
This is not your – it's based on the original.
It is based on the story of Sleeping Beauty, but this is a much darker –
Much darker.
Yeah, from a great French director, Catherine Beyat. And it's I think this – we found this at Toronto, I think, last fall. I think it was the first place we had seen that. And not distributed yet in this country. It's not clear how much distribution it's going to get. So this may be your only chance to see it in Baltimore.
And you've got – let me see. There's so many films here to talk about. Raymond and Lena. Is that it? Mm-hmm. Lina? It was done by Mark Pagan.
Oh, indeed. Yep. So we're – the variety of films coming in, we've got – I mean, that reminds me of something that's sort of been a tradition. There's this young group of filmmakers, sort of artisanal filmmakers that have, you know, gotten a lot of play or doing major festivals, have not really hit the distribution side of things yet. But their sort of godfather is a guy named Joe Swanberg. And we've had his films at the festival before. Greta Gerwig, an actress who he discovered, is now in the new Arthur, one of these big studio films.
Right.
He was in the Ben Stiller film Greenberg. She's been here a lot and is now, in the last 12 months, really emerging as a major actress. I mean, major studio kind of actress.
Right.
Although still, she's in an independent film we've got here called The Dish and the Spoon. But Swanberg is a very prolific filmmaker, very much an exemplar of this how do you then get to market. And he's made three films that have all been at other festivals, but the Art History is one of those, and that is the North American premiere here. Uncle Kent was at Sundance. Silver Bullets has been at South By. And we're the only festival that's showing all three. So, you know, again, if you're interested in this sort of emerging crop of filmmakers, a lot of people call them mumblecore, which I think is
– Where does that come from?
Well, I think it's because it's sort of handheld filmmaking. Uh-huh. And I think there was, you know, young people and characters and about sort of personal stories. So I think, you know, there was some mumbling, I guess, is what somebody would say. But I think artisanal is more the way to look at it.
Right.
I mean, it's like somebody, instead of having a big farm, you know, raising a very special kind of chicken and taking that to market. It's much more in that mode than it is. And they're pretty fascinating movies. You know, they're not for everybody, but they're – and there's something very new that's coming, and it is definitely impacting bigger studio stuff too.
Some other things here we might be talking about in the course of the hour: Everyday Sunshine, the story of Fishbone, about the band, the Fishbone.
Yeah, and we have people on our advisory committee, and Eric and Scott, both in our office, are much more tuned into the whole music world. I love music, but I'm not as tuned in as they are. I had never heard of Fishbone, and I'm telling you, this story is unbelievable. I mean, the performance stuff is breathtaking. And the band dynamic, I mean, this was a band that chose to do everything collectively. I mean, they literally would take votes on everything, you know, where they would tour, who their record label would be. And it sort of undermined them. I mean, and you'll see all through the film, I mean, the Red Hot Chili Peppers. I mean, you've got people in this film saying this is one of the most seminal bands ever. And I'd never heard of them, Fishbone. But you'll really be astounded you never heard of them once you see them in performance, because they are unbelievable.
Tell me, give us a couple of films before we go back to getting people to get there that really we haven't talked about that grabs you, that you really love bringing to this festival.
Well, we're involved in two. You know, we have a little program with Sundance called the Maryland Filmmakers Fellowship. And we get ordinary people together who read scripts that come out of Sundance. These are completely unknown filmmakers' scripts. They know no background about the filmmakers. And a couple years ago, we gave a grant to an Inupiat Eskimo from Barrow, Alaska, which I had never heard of Barrow, Alaska, but it's 340 miles north of the Arctic
Circle.
It's
cold up there.
It is. It's like one of the most northern towns in the world. There are no paved streets in Barrow, and there are no streets from Barrow to anywhere else. And to give you an idea.
Fly in.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So to give you an idea of how remote this is. And Andrew Opeka McLean made this movie about teenagers in Barrow, people he knew. And it's fiction. It's not a documentary. But all the actors are non-professional actors that he cast, shot in real places in Barrow, real homes in Barrow. So it's this completely odd setting for most of us, and even odd culture, you know, because we're not Inupiat Eskimos. But what he's done is to find the universality of teenage boys trying to grow up and trying to confront the issues as they leave high school. And in this case, do you leave your community? How's your relationship to your folks, to the traditions in this case? So in many ways, it's a universal movie, and it is just beautifully made. And again, it was at Sundance this year and did very well at Sundance, but you know, I don't even think it has distribution yet. So,
and the film's coming here?
On the Ice, and Kara Marcus, who's very involved with the film, one of the producers, will be here. So that's one we haven't mentioned that is a good one. I talked about Kwame Arma's Frankenstein hosting.
That's going to be amazing.
Frankenstein. Another one called Restless City comes from a filmmaker whose work we've also supported. He won the Maryland Filmmakers Fellowship from another script he had done, not this script, called Mother of George. But this is also one that's come through the festival world. It premiered at Sundance and is just terrific. I think you're going to try to do an interview with an Academy Award-nominated filmmaker named Marshall Curry.
Yes.
Who did a movie. We've had a couple of his movies here. He did a movie about the Newark mayor
New York mayor's race.
Yeah, when Cory Booker, who's now the mayor, but when he lost the first time he ran for mayor, called Street Fight, and he was nominated for Academy Award for that. And then he did a film about kids learning to be NASCAR drivers called Racing Dreams that we had a couple years ago that, again, went on to great acclaim. This is called If a Tree Falls.
Amazing movie.
And it's about a young middle-class kid from New York getting caught up in—
Working-class kid. His father was a cop.
Yeah. And getting caught up in the protest movements in the Northwest trying to preserve these old-growth trees.
And, the Earth Liberation Front.
Yeah, called the Earth Liberation Front. And he I didn't really even know about this. I mean, I sort of had in my head, well, you know, you log and then the lumber companies now, either by law or by their own self-interest, replant the forest and we've got more trees than we had 200 years ago and blah, blah, blah. What they're talking about are trees that are 750 to 1,000 years old that are not replaceable. I mean, they're certainly not replaceable in my, you know,
probably
lifetime,
not, right,
my kid's lifetime or my grandkid's lifetime. And they don't want them logged just like any old tree. You know, they think these are precious objects. And they start out sort of imaginative, nonviolent protest. And it works a little bit, and then they get, you know, various kinds of responses from ignoring to brutality from authorities. And they start taking this violent, very specifically done, but very violent path. And Marshall's smart enough to have shown this through this guy's eyes. And it all started when his wife in her office, these federal marshals showed up one day and arrested this guy. She didn't know anything about this guy's background. And it's a really instructive movie about American politics, about all politics, not just
all
American
politics,
and how democracy works,
works and doesn't work.
Exactly.
There's so much to this film festival. This is very exciting. Always is very exciting.
Thanks.
We want folks to come, and you'll be hearing conversations we'll be having with a number of filmmakers leading up to the festival in the next hour. And right now with Jed Dietz, who is the founding director and of creative director of the Maryland Film Festival, 13th year. And we want you all to join us Thursday night through Sunday down by the Charles Theater.
Right.
It's just going to be a gas.
Yeah.
You need to be there.
MDFilmFest.com. And if you forget it, just Google Maryland Film Festival. It'll take you right there.
Or you can go to standardshow.org and click on the button and jump over and
perfect.
Check it all out. And Jed, it'll be great. We'll see you down. See you at the movies.
Indeed. See you, Mark.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show, Public Radio WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. This is Mark Steiner. Welcome back. We are continuing our conversation about what you can see this weekend at the Maryland Film Festival. One of those films is called The Interrupters. Alex Kotlowitz and Steve James, who did Hoop Dreams. Alex Kotlowitz, who's been on our show numerous times for the books he's written about Chicago and inner city issues, made this film together about the men and women who are former gang members, people who have done time in prison, who are working to stop violence in the streets of Chicago. And Alex, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Well, thanks, Mark. It's good to be back.
Quite a collaboration, you and Steve James, Hoop Dreams. How did that come about?
Well, you know, it is a good collaboration. Now, Steve and I are old friends, and we had been trying to figure out something to do together. In fact, we wanted to do something dramatic together, and then I ended up doing this piece on this organization, Ceasefire, for the New York Times Magazine. And it was one of those rare moments I had when I had written something. And I thought, you know, this is actually a better film if we could get the kind of access that we needed. And Steve, I've been talking to Steve about the piece, and he read it and had the same thought. And so we ended up spending a couple of years together working on this. It was a good partnership.
And it's talk a bit about The Interrupters. Give our listeners a sense who The Interrupters are and what this film did.
Right. So these are men and women formerly of the street, many of them former gang members, drug dealers, who for whatever reason have reached a point in their life when they have decided that there's a second act for them. And so many of them in their 30s, 40s, even 50s. And they work for an organization Care, which was founded by an infectious disease doctor who spent 10 years in Africa and came back here to this country in the mid-90s, was struck by the violence in our cities, especially in Chicago where he was from, and began to look at violence as mimicking the spread of infectious disease and began to think, why not approach it from a public health perspective? And so actually what they did, the Interrupters in some ways mirror what they did, what he did in Uganda when he was with World Health. You know, when they were battling AIDS, they'd hire former sex workers to go out and try to change the sexual behavior of people in that country. And so what he's done here is they've hired these men and women formerly of the street to go out and try to change behavior. And what they do is they go out into their communities that they've been assigned to try to suss out disputes and intervene before they turn violent. They do amazing work, and so they're out there often mediating conflicts, trying to interrupt the next shooting.
I'm going to play a little clip here, and the clip is from the barbershop where this kid comes home from prison.
How y'all doing? I understand that on August 24th, 2007, that me and two other fellas came in here and stuck the place up. I know I'm deeply sorry. I know I made a mistake. I was 15, and I was following the crowd, but now I'm older. I'm more mature than I was, and I wanted to let y'all know that I was sorry for what I did on my behalf. I don't know how these two other brothers feel about themselves, but I know I made a complete 360 almost 3 years being incarcerated.
And so, that to me was an amazing little piece in there, because it said so much about the gentleman who's coming with you at the film festival,
right,
who worked with this kid, who kid comes out of prison and goes back to this barbershop to try to find a way to make himself whole in the community, to apologize for the crime he committed.
Right.
That was such an... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, no, amazing young man and an amazing moment. I mean, you're right, little Mikey gets out of prison. He's been there for nearly 3 years. He's all of 17 years old. And one of the things he's most determined to do is he wants to take ownership for what he did. He and two other young men had robbed a barbershop at gunpoint to get money actually to buy guns because they were in a gang war. And he was determined to go back and apologize. And it was interesting when... And so Kobe, one of the interrupters, who's one of the three interrupters, who's kind of the spine of the film, picks little Mikey up from prison. He knew him from when he was younger. And Kobe is the one who goes with him to the barbershop. And when Kobe originally went to the barbershop was said, you know, we don't really want to be a part of this. You know, it was not a good experience. We don't trust this kid. And so it took some real convincing to get them to allow little Mikey to come back. And there's this incredible moment where this mother who was there getting a haircut for her and her children relives the whole experience. I mean, does not let little Mikey off the hook. And it, you know, somehow finds a way to forgive him, to let him know that it's okay. It really is this astonishing moment. I mean, there's something really restorative about it. I mean, restorative for little Mikey, and I think restorative for the people who were on the other end of that robbery.
And Kobe was coming down. Spent 12 years in prison himself. He's one of the interrupters who brought little Mikey to this barbershop. That's the heart and soul of this program, which I think that people really have a hard time putting their hands around, that these are people like the woman Amina and others who have committed crimes, who've done some horrendous things, but have come back to transform themselves, to live a life to transform their communities.
Right. No, Kobe was little Mikey. Kobe was, you know, he was in the street. He was in the street, you know, shooting at people and getting shot at. And he spends off and on a total of 12 years in prison. I mean, what for him was a kind of turning point was when he's in court one day and his four-year-old son runs up to him in tears and hugs him and won't let go of him. And Kobe realizes, you know what? I gotta do something with my life. I need to be there for my son. His father, Kobe's own father, was killed when Kobe was 12. And that was it. I mean, it was kind of the breaking point for him. And he's a guy now who, you know, is raising four children with his wife out in the suburbs. And every day he drives back into the city to deal with the little Mikeys, the people who really were once him out on the street. And with little Mikey, he's kind of a mentor. I mean, in some ways, his role with little Mikey in the film is not even part of his job description, because really his job description is to go out and try to intervene in conflicts. And here's a kid getting out of prison, and Kobe, you know, sees that this is a kid who needs somebody to help guide him, who just needs a hand.
And it's not all men. This is the woman, Amina.
Right. It's not all men, though mostly. There are two women at the table, and one of them, Amina Matthews, is at the center of the film. I mean, she's a force of nature. And Amina is the daughter of a legendary gang leader in Chicago, Jeff Fort. And Amina herself was of the streets. She was an enforcer for a drug dealer, actually a guy who also is an interrupter now. As you see in the film, Amina has this uncanny ability to walk into just about any situation and diffuse it and disarm people. She's straight with people. She's blunt-spoken. She's got a sense of humor. And I think in some ways, because she is a woman, it allows her to go into places that some of her colleagues can't.
Yeah, the scene that she has where she's speaking to that congregation,
right.
Someone's been killed, and Amina, who's become a Muslim.
Right. I mean, that's an amazing, again, another astonishing moment where she's invited by a family who doesn't even know her. They've just reached out to ceasefire. They need somebody there to help, you know, deal with the young people who are just filled with this sense of rage. Their friend's been shot and killed on the street, and this worry about retaliation. And so Amina goes to this funeral and calls the kids, the young people there, out on it, and asks them what they think they're doing. And in that funeral, she invokes the name of her father, who everybody knows by reputation, and tells them that this is not what her father would want. It's also partly what gives her that power on the street.
So the way you two made this film, you and Steve James, great collaboration, I think, between an amazing filmmaker and someone who understands the substance of this world, as you do, Alex. Mm-hmm. And you also built this film so it has kind of dramatic arcs to it.
Right.
Which I kind of like the way you approached it. You did, this is very real. You're not cutting out language. You're cutting, this is the real streets. This is the real, this is what happens when you're down on the corner. You just feel it, you hear it, you see it, but you will also build this arc of stories that keep you riveted inside. I mean, that was obviously a conscious dramatic decision.
Right. I mean, I think two things. I think one is that, you know, Steve and I from the outset, we knew that neither of us were interested in making reality TV.
That's a good thing.
Right. I mean, right. It is a good thing. And,
right.
And it would probably have been easy to do in some ways, but we knew that really we wanted to get as intimate as we could with the three main characters and, of course, the people that they meet, and to follow up on stories. So, for example, there's an individual that Kobe pulls off the ledge. He's about to go off and shoot four people. And if it were reality TV, that scene, which is filled with emotion and anger, if not rage, would have been enough, but we wanted to go back and back and back to track what happened with him. But the other part of it is that I think Steve and I mean, I think one of the things that we share deeply is this absolute commitment to story or to narrative. And so one of the challenges for us was to figure out, as you said, how to pull a narrative out of these stories. And really, I think what ends up driving the film, it's a year in the life of the city with these three main characters. But it's the people they meet, the little Mikeys, whose stories unfold during the course of that year, that keep you, I think, hopefully, keep you watching, wondering. And constantly, I think, at least for me, because I can tell you when I was filming, constantly astonished by by what happened.
You were astonished by what happened?
Yeah. I mean, without giving away too much in the film.
Right, no, right, right.
But there's, you know, again, one individual, Kobe, you know, has to deal with Flamo, who,
oh, right,
when we first meet him, he is just, I mean, he's a bit, he's what I think people think of when they think of these communities. It's this young man just filled with rage. He can't see anything else outside of that.
Over the top, on edge, wants to just take
action.
Yeah,
I mean, he he's got his gun in his pants. He's got a what you don't see in the film is somebody's about to deliver a stolen car to him so he can go out and commit these murders. But Kobe's able to pull him off the ledge. And what happens to Flamo, for me, was pretty surprising. Again, I don't want to.
No, we won't give it away. It is pretty surprising, and that's the thing. When you look at the three people you focused on, is the work they do to pull people back from the edge, to respect them, their worlds, their lives, and bring them back from the edge and try to say there's another way.
Right, and what I think what you said was really important. You know, to do it with respect. I mean, the thing that was most and inspiring to me and was how each of them, Kobe, Amin, and Eddie, were able to pull people down without passing judgment. I mean, my inclination would be go out there and lecture somebody like Flamo and saying, hey, man, you know what you're doing is wrong. You can't be doing this. But, you know, Kobe goes out there and tries to appeal to all the possible, find a way to pull them down. You know, at one point they suggest that maybe they could intervene, and his brother's in jail as a result of what had happened, and so they say, maybe we could get the guys who you're about to go kill pay for his bail. You know, what about your mom? You've got kids. You know, all the things I think that are important, that they think might be important to somebody like Flamo, and to sort of pull him again off that ledge without passing judgment. I mean, I'm just was constantly in awe of how they were able to do that.
And the film also doesn't pull punches in terms of the horrendousness of the violence that takes place. I mean, you blur things so it doesn't become to make it kind of so we're not kind of leading to a purian interest to want to watch some violence.
Right.
But the rawness of it is important, and how raw can change to something else.
Right. And we, you know, again, wanted to be careful. I don't think there are too many. And in fact, I can only really think of one kind of cringe-inducing moment in the film, which is a, you know, videotape that was widely circulated both here and abroad. You know, the brutal death of Darian Albert, a Chicago public school student that happened on the street that drew all this attention to Chicago. And it just so happened it occurred early on in our filming. And so we do use a clip of that video. And I do think it's important on some level. I mean, the violence, I mean, that it, you're able to really grapple with it in a real way. But I think that's the only moment in the film. I mean, we wanted to be careful. I mean, in some ways, I think if you think about it, here's this film, 2-hour and 20-minute film about violence, and you actually see very little actual violence.
Right.
In the film.
Very little.
Yeah. And I hope what you get is a real sense of intimacy with both the three main characters and the people they've got to tangle with.
And the three main characters' families. I mean, here's people off the street, but who live very kind of stable lives.
Right.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, no, you're right. Each of them in their own way have kind of found their footing. You know, Amina's, has two young children. She's married to a sheikh at a small mosque. Her Muslim faith is incredibly important to her. You've got Kobe, who lives out in the far west suburbs with his wife, who is a emergency room nurse. And, you know, again, he's got four kids, one who biological kid and three stepchildren, and just doing an amazing job raising them. And then you've got Eddie Bocanegra.
Oh, yes.
Whom we haven't spoken about, who, you know, at 17 committed murder, and it was, you know, spent 14 years in prison. And his story, in some ways, is a kind of very internal one. I mean, he's really looking for a way to try to forgive himself for what he did.
He's a man in pain, deep emotional pain because of what he wrought.
Yeah, he is in pain. He's an incredibly thoughtful, deeply thoughtful individual, and in some ways, I think doing penance for what he did, and just trying to figure out a way to sort of so that that moment in which he took somebody else's life doesn't come to define him.
That moment in the film when Eddie is talking to the kids and the you get a sense of the post-traumatic trauma that these children feel because of the death and killing around them and the violence around them.
Right. So I think Eddie, because of what he wrought on the streets, is very, very conscious of sort of the effect the violence has on the sort of human psyche. And he knows very well what it's done to him. And so he's really cognizant when he goes out and works with these kids. And there's this moment, as you say, where he goes to a school, and he became a really accomplished artist when he was in prison. And so he, one of the things that he does on his own time is goes and teaches art to kids in school. And he's teaching an art class after school program to middle schoolers. And at one point, he asks them what worries them in their communities, and they all talk about the violence. And at one point, one of the girls talks about a shooting, in which actually nobody was shot, but she becomes so emotional that she just can't get through the telling of the story. And I think Eddie, you can see Eddie completely identifies with her, knows how difficult it is to somehow digest all that and how to keep on going. There's a family that he also spends time with that you meet in the film, who's lost a son, 14-year-old son, to the violence.
Oh, yes.
And they're spending
right.
every single day at the cemetery. That moment for me is just it does so much.
So, Alex, tell me what it is that you two want to see done with this film.
Right. You know, I think both Steve and myself, in some ways this is a film that kind of bookends his first film, Hoop Dreams, and my first book, There Are No Children Here. You know, both of them grappled with issues of the kind of profound and deep poverty in our cities. And I think subsequent to his film and my book, each of us has personally experienced the violence in these communities. I know that two of the characters in Hoop Dreams have since been murdered, and three of the kids that I knew and There Are No Children Here have since been killed. And I think what you see out there, both in these communities and also outside, is a kind of resignation, a kind of paralysis or numbness that's set in. And our hope with the film is to stir the conversation and I think to offer some sense of promise. You can't help but spend time with Kobe, Eddie, and Amina and think to yourself, you know what? There is a way out of this.
There is a way out of it. This is I can't wait to see the you here, the audience seeing this film, and we will May the 7th at 11 a.m. at the Micah Brown Center at the Brown Institute College of Art, and not to be missed. And very powerful film, and I'm glad you're bringing it here. And you and Kobe will present this together, so it could be a very interesting morning.
Yeah, well, we're looking forward to it. We'll do a Q&A afterwards, so it should be fun. But, Mark, thanks for having me on your show.
Alex Kotlowitz, is always good to talk to you, and thank you so much for The Interrupters.
Well, thanks.
Thank
you're
you.
Welcome.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. You can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com. I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. Continue our conversation about the Maryland Film Festival and talking with some of the filmmakers and Jed Dietz, the founder and director of the Maryland Film Festival. We're now about to have a conversation with Marshall Curry, whose film, If a Tree Falls, A Story of the Earth Liberation Front, is this Saturday, May the 7th, at 2 p.m., I believe. And that'll be on our website as well. And Marshall, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Marshall, one of the things that struck me here, your earlier film with Cory Booker, before he became mayor of Newark, and this new film, to me struck me as kind of films about people who believe deeply in the struggles they're fighting for, and you like to kind of explore the complexities of those struggles.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. I mean, seeing people trying to take on the system, whether it's, you know, Cory Booker running against Sharp James, who'd been the mayor for 16 years, was kind of the machine boss of Newark when Cory was running against him, or Daniel McGowan, although I'm sure Cory Booker would not necessarily like to be considered in the same category as environmentalists who burn down buildings.
But he does. He does want to stand with the people who move into a housing project. That he
loves.
That's
he certainly will do that.
He would do that. And tell us how you, many people in the world have never heard of the Earth Liberation Front. It was in the news for a while, way back when, but if you didn't pay attention to that kind of news, you didn't follow it. So take us back to that and how you stumbled into this story.
Well, I didn't know much about the Earth Liberation Front myself. I'd heard, you know, mentions of it on the news, but had never paid much attention. But one day my wife, who runs a domestic violence organization in Brooklyn, came home from work and said, "You'll never guess what happened today. We had four federal agents walk into the office and arrest one of my employees, who was this guy, Daniel McGowan." And he was somebody who I knew a little bit through her. He faced life in prison for taking part in two arsons of timber facilities in Oregon some years before. At that point, he had been part of the Earth Liberation Front, which is a radical environmental group that was particularly active in the 90s and early 2000s, but still does things today. And they will, you know, burn timber companies or horse slaughterhouses or just businesses in general that they feel are not are damaging the environment in some way.
Dan McGowan is this guy who grows up in New York City and is the son of a cop and goes off to find himself in this environmental movement. The portrait of him in his sister's apartment fighting this case after his arrest, at least for me, was just so moving to watch the pain and struggle he goes through. I mean, looking at him, I mean, you can always think of a terrorist. If you think of somebody as a terrorist, they can be very unassuming characters. But raising the debate of whether this guy was really a terrorist, whether this was really terrorism, going after nothing but material institutions as opposed to human beings, it was a very complex question you wrestled with watching him go through his life at his sister's place.
Right. Yeah. When he was arrested, his sister, again, their family had grown up sort of working class, but she had made a bunch of money at a cosmetic packaging company, actually. And so she put up everything she owned, which was $1.6 million in property and money, in order to get him out on bail. And the condition of that was that he had to live in her apartment and in New York City while he was waiting for his trial. And so kind of the arc of the movie is him from the time he was arrested until the time he goes to prison. But it's, you know, there's a lot of backstory that explores how it was that he wound up facing life in prison for terrorism. And his sister, I think, is one of my favorite characters because she doesn't necessarily share his philosophy, but she loves her brother and she's willing to do whatever it takes to support him and has a kind of a common sense approach to some of the questions about, you know, terrorism and activism.
So, where did you tell me how you walked away from this film? What you know, every filmmaker, any writer, any of us who goes to do a story that we're not sure of all the components of the story and the human beings we're about to meet, come away moved and affected by what we see. I'm very curious about how this, what happened to you in the process of putting this particular film together and what you came to at the end.
It was really a journey for me. You know, I was, like I say, it sort of dropped in my lap. I was kind of planning to work on another film with Sam Coleman, who is the cinematographer and co-director on this movie. And when it dropped in our lap, we just sort of said, well, we don't really know much about the Earth Liberation Front, but let's find out. And I think that our point of view was shifted again and again and again as we were making the movie, spending time with people who defended the Earth Liberation Front. You know, the former spokesman, and he explains why they did these fires, what the kind of logic behind them was, and then spending time with the prosecutor, spending time with the detective who worked for years on the case trying to crack the group, spending time with the arson victims themselves. film is not a polemical film. It's a, it
right.
is a, I mean, the goal is just to shed light. It's not to answer these questions, shed light on them. And I studied religion when I was in college. And when I graduated, one of my friends said to me, you know, I'm still confused, but just at a higher level. And I think that's kind of the goal of this film. It's to say, listen, these are real complicated issues. We're not going to sew them all up in 85 minutes and tell you what the answer is. But hopefully by the end of it, people will when they use the word terrorism or when they discuss how you know what is terrorism or when they think about activism, whether it's environmental activism or any other kind of activism, they'll think about the tactics and what makes sense and what makes people do the things that they do. And hopefully, no matter where somebody falls on the spectrum, whether they're deep radical environmentalists, whether they're sort of mainstream environmentalists, whether they're industry people, that they will all be nudged a little bit out of their comfort zone.
I think that is all very true. I mean, I think that you, in this film, one of the things that struck me was the three things. In terms of the people. A was the guy who the cop who tracked him, and almost the glee in his eye as he began to turn the case.
That right.
Watching him kind of be gleeful about this was really interesting to watch how that worked. The heroin addict outlaw who was, as happens many times in these movements, is looked on by the middle class kids as this great kind of cool guy because he's a real working class outlaw, and how he turns, the kind of demon he becomes in some ways, and then the young people themselves, like through McGowan's eyes and the others that are interviewed, seen as people who didn't disown what they did, but began to kind of the frailty of the human spirit kind of took over. As they stood up, and how so few of them actually stood up and refused to buckle completely. That was a really interesting study in all those kind of human characters and the flaws, and in a really kind of, I don't want to say Shakespearean sense, but in a sense, of, perhaps in that sense as well, you know, just really capturing the human beings in struggle and with all their flaws.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it is not a story of heroes and villains. It's really much more a story of complicated real people with gray inside them. The goal of the film really is to be a cautionary tale to activists to say, think carefully about the tactics that you choose. Because I think by the end of the film, it would be pretty hard to think that arson is a great idea and arson is a good way of achieving your goals just because it's dangerous, because it's, you know, in many cases counterproductive. You know, people write off the environmental movement when they see people doing things like that. And it's also, you know, when you make a mistake, if you attack the wrong company, it's impossible to undo those mistakes. But I also think that it's a cautionary tale for the rest of us, for society in general, to say, what are the ways that we deal with protesters, and what are the things that radicalize people, and what are the things that can bring people into the democratic process to you know, kind of encourage them to be a part of that process to make change that way.
Marsh Croy, thank you so much for taking this time with us. I'm really looking forward to seeing you present your film and having this community come down to the Maryland Film Festival and checking this out.
Thanks so much. I'm looking forward to meeting people and talking to them after the screening.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.